God Dude. This is Steve-O. Thank you for listening.
All right, everybody, welcome to another episode of the Drilled with Dr. Brady podcast. This is Dr. Brady. We have someone on today who actually knows what they're talking about in their profession. This is exciting to me. Yeah, it's not just me and Lowell, guys. It's someone who knows some stuff, all right? We sought high and low for experts in the field of oral pathology. Now, a lot of people don't even know what oral pathology is. We're going to get into that. But we have Dr. Ashley Clark with us, who is an oral pathologist. Ashley, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Don't overpromise on my knowledge base, by the way.
Well, you are. If I'm the standard, you are the A+. That's what you are.
If it's any consolation, I have no clue. So I am just, you want to talk about winging it? That's me.
Ashley. You are an oral pathologist. Is that correct?
That part is correct. Yes, I'm a board certified oral pathologist.
Board certified even. Okay.
Board certified.
So let me ask you this. Let's start with this. Let me start with, how about I explain to you what I think you do?
I think that would be really interesting. I would love to hear.
And then you tell me how close I am or how far away I am.
Okay. Let's do that.
Before you just spill the beans on what you do, that's not fun. That's boring. Let's see if I'm even close. Okay. And I think, and I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that I speak for all dentists, every single one of them, every general dentist, about what an oral pathology, what an oral pathologist does. Here's what I think. And this is as accurate as I can be. Okay. I think you work somewhere.
Yes.
I'm on the right track already.
You are on it so far.
Okay. I think you work somewhere that probably requires a lanyard with your photo on it. I think you walk into a building and you go somewhere on an elevator, possibly, and you go into a room, maybe a lab type of room, probably limited windows, maybe bars, I don't know. But there you look at microscope slides, you open packages, you open FedEx and UPS packages, which have body parts in them. And then you look at those body parts and you cut them into small pieces and you do tests on them. And then you write notes back to dentists telling them if it's interesting or not. How close am I?
For a portion of what I do, you are pretty spectacularly dead on.
Yes.
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 So that is about 40% of my FTE, to use like a little bit of academia.
What's FTE? I don't know what that means.
So I work at a university. Most pathologists work at a university. And you alluded to that too, right? So we go into a place with an elevator and get into...
And do you have a lanyard? Tell me you have a lanyard.
Now, I do not have a lanyard, but I do have one of those little things that I had a lanyard at University of Texas at Houston where I used to work. So I think you can have that one.
Okay.
You have a decontamination room? I'd really like to know if you have a decontamination room. You go in and spray down.
It's a good question.
We have all of that because we have, you know, a CLIA approved lab. So we have, you know, the thing where if you want to shower, we've got that. But I don't know that we have a decontamination room. So, this is my first office I've ever had with windows. This is my third institution I've been working at. So first one with windows. I actually kind of prefer to not have the windows. I like being in my little closed off pathology hole. So you were pretty accurate. We open up our FedEx today. We got because of the weather there were some delays. We got 61 packages today, so tomorrow
and inside the packages are body parts, biopsies,
basically.
I say body parts. There's not actually like severed legs or things like that, but
they're about that big, so
pieces of tongues and pieces of cheeks and chunks of stuff that are just
chunks
in
of
there.
Stuff that didn't belong there in the first place. Yeah.
Right. And your job is to open all 61. It's like, you know, it's like Amazon day at my house when all the Amazon packages come. But for you, you got to open up and figure out. You open it up and you still don't know what it is. You got to figure it out once you get in there.
So we gross it. We gross the specimen. Our pathologists here do our own grossing. So we prepare the specimen to be embedded in paraffin and cut. And then we look at it under my microscope right here. So, So we look at it under the microscope the next day and tell the clinicians what it was.
Okay, so let's back up a little bit because I think we're getting ahead of our listeners. A lot of our listeners are not dentists.
Yes, okay.
And some of our listeners are absolutely dentists. I think this is valuable information for either group. But what I want people to understand is that oral pathology is a specialty like an orthodontist or an endodontist or an oral surgeon. It's a similar specialty. Now, there's just not as many of you as there are oral surgeons. You don't have, I guess you'd say, you don't have the traditional private practice that that some of these other specialties that we commonly know about have.
Very few of us do. Yeah.
Right. So let's go back into your decision to become an oral pathologist. Was that something that you became enamored with during dental school, or did you know from the beginning? So you went through dental school, you graduated in 2010 from Indiana, as what you said. Okay, so you graduated 2010 in Indiana. So we started right about the same exact time. And at some point you said, I think I'm going to be an oral pathologist. And I want to know what led you to that and when did that happen within your career?
So I quickly learned in dental school that number one, I did not enjoy it very much, but more importantly, I was not terribly talented at it. And after, not good at all. So after, really great at taking the tests. Like I could do that. part I was good at. But when it came to working on the teeth in the lab, not so good. So I thought I'm going to have to drop out of dental school and go to medical school because I just don't think I can do this. And my second year, we had pathology. And I was like, oh, that's it. That's where it is. So I went to my pathology professor at the time. His name was Nadim Islam. And I said, I want to do what you do. Help me do what you do. And he said, why don't you go work on actual human beings and you get the patient interaction and then see if you want to still do what I do and give it a year. So 365 days later, to the minute, I knocked on his door and said, please help me do what you do. So it was something I knew right away that I wanted to do. And it, at the time, was a bit unusual to go straight from dental school to residency. There weren't a whole lot of, to pathology residency specifically, there weren't a whole lot of people who did that.
Yeah, right out of school into pathology, that's not very common to do that.
I didn't know pathology existed when I went into dental school. And I would imagine most people are, I mean, maybe not most, but a lot of people are like that.
Yeah, well, I know lots of dentists go out into the field of general dentistry and decide it's not for them and they go back and specialize. So is that usually what happens with oral pathologists? Most oral pathologists were in private practice or out as a general dentist for some period of time and then go back to school.
So at a certain point, I would say that is true. Most went and did some dentistry or did a GPR or, you know, spent some real life, had some real life experience with actual clinical dentistry and then came back. Now, I don't know if that's the case anymore, if people are still going straight into oral pathology residency out of dental school. That's a whole separate conversation. You know, there's limited jobs and you have to work where there's an opening. So there's some limitations there. So I think a lot of people maybe want that freedom to move around. But if you're like me, there was no other option. It was pathology or bust. So,
yeah. And it's a 3-year rotation.
Three-year residency.
And they're all 3-year residencies?
Yes. Yeah. That's part of our accreditation standards, not to get too boring, but you know, dental schools and programs have to be accredited by a central body. And part of that is having a 36-month program.
Okay. So let me take a second to explain to the listener what it is, at what point in my day-to-day do I come into need of an oral pathologist? It's definitely not a daily thing.
Yeah.
But every now and then, but there's a lot of dentists. There's what 250,000 dentists in the United States. Do you know how many oral pathologists there are?
There are between 200 and 300 working pathologists in the United States, depending on what you look at. So I'm in Lexington and we happen to have a ton of oral pathologists in Kentucky. But when I worked in West Virginia, I was the only oral pathologist that was still working there because the other ones had retired. So it just depends on where you are, how densely saturated your area is.
So I don't think I'm too far off if I say there's probably 100 times more dentists than there are oral pathologists.
Gotta be.
So basically you could narrow it down to every oral pathologist is basically, you know, handling 100 dentists when they see things that are, that they don't know, that they feel like they should know. So anyway, day to day, you know, I see a number of patients every single day, and I see them for a new patient exam. And sometimes I see them as a periodic exam, meaning that they're patients of record. They're coming to get cleanings done every 6 months. And so I look inside the mouth and I know what a normal mouth looks like. And I know when I see something that's not normal, based on color, texture, size, location, orientation, all these different things, symmetry versus asymmetry, and all these different things. And I get to the point in my career where I know what normal looks like, and I know what not normal looks like. So then I see something that's not normal. And when I see something that's not normal, I start thinking to myself, what is that? Does the patient know that there's something in their mouth that's not normal? Do I tell them? Am I going to scare them if I tell them? How do I tell them about this? So there's all these questions going on in a dentist's mind when they see something that's not normal. Now, sometimes a patient comes and says, I got something in my mouth that's not, I don't think is normal. And sometimes it's easy for me to explain in a way that I don't need an oral pathologist. For example, an abscess. You know, I can solve that without taking a biopsy or pulling a tooth out or doing a root canal or whatever I got to do to solve that. Those actually still would be normal. It's the disease process that behaves normally, as you would expect one to. But then I see things that I cannot explain or that I don't know, or that maybe I remember from a pathology textbook or a lecture from years ago. And I think maybe we should know what that is. And so my job is either to take the biopsy myself or send it to an oral surgeon that takes the biopsy, and they put it in a little container, little tube. They shove it in a FedEx box and they send it to Dr. Ashley Clark.
Hopefully,
or someone,
yeah.
Or someone like Ashley Clark. So that's a day in the life of, and now what are you, when I hand it over to you, what are you doing with it? You actually went over, you said something about grossing
I will gross the specimen.
Gross the specimen. What's that?
So
what is grossing a specimen?
Take it out of the bottle.
Okay.
It's actually quite challenging because our pieces of tissue or the specimen that we get, they're really tiny.
Yeah.
So we are very careful not to lose them, which has happened in the history of time. But we take them out. I describe them, you know, this is one white papillary thing or one white round thing, measure them. And then if we need to, we cut them to get them a nice flat edge. So the histotechnician, which we have our own histotechnician here, the lab's right across the hallway. So I keep gesturing over there. But so their histotechnician can,
it's not your kitchen at your house. That's not what you're pointing
it is.
At.
Well, I've had specimens in the kitchen, but
it's COVID. You got to do what you got to do.
Yeah, exactly. So, I was kidding for the record, but, so we cut them. So she has a nice flat edge to lay them on. She does her thing. She stains them with hematoxylin and eosin. And then she gives them to me and I look at them under the microscope.
So what she's talking about, and you're talking about preparing a slide,
yeah,
which means you're using dyes of some sort, and you're cutting pieces small and flat so that you have a good view of that. Cause you're looking at a cross section. You're looking at the actual cellular composition of the specimen you're receiving to see Well, how normal? Because I talked about, like, I can see something that's not normal, but you're looking at the cellular structure to find what's normal, what's not normal. Is that
exactly accurate? Exactly. How much inflammation is there that maybe shouldn't be there? Stuff like that.
Okay. And then I'm waiting for you to send something back to me. So what does the doctor, when you're done with what you're doing, what does the doctor expect? What is the reasonable expectation of the general dentist or this, or the oral surgeon when they get the package back from you?
So that depends on the practice that you use and the pathologist's personality, basically. So we use a computer system that when I am done, I hit enter and it automatically faxes my report to the doctor. So our turnaround time here is about 24 hours after we receive the specimen, the doctor has our diagnosis. 48 hours max. If it takes longer than 48 hours, I call the doctor and say, hey, it's going to be a couple of days. Make sure you didn't, you know, schedule the patient. So what they get back is a fax and then an email with the diagnosis. I don't like to put a lot of treatment recommendations on there because I worry that can get the doctor into trouble. So I personally don't do things like that, but some doctors like that and some pathologists do that for them. So they can expect that if they ask for it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's the next question is, what do you do once you find out what this something is? If it's something weird. So it's either, you know, I don't want to put words in your mouth. Let me ask you this. Most of the time, do the diagnoses require treatment? I guess what I'm getting at is like, what, I don't know if I want to say like what percentage, but do you deal with a lot of things that are like, hey, this requires really time sensitive action? I'm talking about like oral cancer.
Oral cancers.
You know, if something's cancerous, something could grow, something could be spread, be more potentially dangerous. Do we deal with that a lot? Or is it mostly like, this is nothing?
I would say the majority of things are nothing, right? Fibromas, mucoceles, papillomas, things like that. Just benign tumors that their treatment is to cut them out. So that's been done, no further action. For our cancers, every single doctor who does a biopsy on a cancer, their office or themselves, they'll get a phone call from me. If it's an unexpected diagnosis or if it's a really, poor prognosis for the patient, then I'll call the doctor myself instead of just the office. And then what I'll do on my end is I will go ahead and sign the case out as best I can without ordering special tests. So that way, because our biopsy specimens come in from all across the country. So we have, a person in Washington, let's say, if they have a cancer that needs a lot of workup on my end, I'll sign it out as a cancer. So their surgeon, whoever did the biopsy, can get them into a cancer treatment center. And that process can start immediately. So they don't have to wait for my extra stains. Then I'll order my extra tests. When that comes through, then I'll fax the final report. So for cancers and things that are time sensitive, I do my best to get the patient moving.
Do you ever have patients that want to deal directly with you? And is that allowed? Is it done?
I don't know if it's not allowed. It might not be, but it is definitely frowned upon. So whomever does the biopsy ought to be the person talking to the patient. It really should not be me. Now, if a doctor, let's say you do a biopsy and I say, doc, this is what's something fancy that you might not know?
I already know all the fancy things. So
this is a melanotic neuroectodermal tumor of infancy.
Yeah, I don't know that.
Okay. I try to think of something we don't teach. So every once in a while, the doctor will say, can you please talk to my patient? And in that case, I am happy to do that.
Well, the doctor will ask you to.
Sometimes the doctor will ask me. Hardly, I would say in the past, I've been doing this since 2013. I would say maybe two doctors have asked me to do that in all of that time.
Interesting. Okay.
But that's the only time I ever talk to patients.
Is it like a psychological thing where you want to create some separation from like emotion? Like, I'm just thinking, like, let's say someone gives you a really bad diagnosis, like a squamous cell carcinoma that is progressed, and it's a bad prognosis, and now I got to have this. So I've found oral cancer 2 times in my 12 years, 2 times, and both times it was the one time it was the side of the tongue.
Okay.
Something was growing there that looked like a wart to me. Like a reddish, whitish wart looking thing, but like a little knob in the tongue. Anyway, I felt not good about that. And then the other time was on the, would have been the buccal mucosa of around tooth number 30, lower right on the aspect that faces the cheek. It was where he put his chewing tobacco, and so it's just that tissue tends to look like it looks like people's fingers after they swim for a long time.
It's exactly what it looks like.
Like
yeah.
A ring. Yeah, it looks like this ring. It looks like you've been underwater for like days. And so that's what it looked like. But it also started to look really ulcerated, really nasty looking. And both times, I kind of knew in my head, I was like, this is not going to be a good diagnosis. But if I was getting that. Now I send it to the oral surgeon because as a general dentist, I don't really do biopsies. And so I knew it needed to be biopsied. And so the surgeon kind of told me, so I wasn't ever the one, I've never had to tell a patient, hey, this is.
It ought to be the person worst who diagnosis. The
biopsy.
Yeah.
But I could see them want to be like, well, I want to hear it from the person who diagnosed it. I want to hear it from the pathologist. Maybe I like an emotional response to like a, so I wonder if there's a benefit from just like, separate, like you just don't get emotionally tied. You're just looking at slides and saying, this is what I see. And it's very didactic. It's very just academic and fact-based and not, you don't have a face in front of it. And that's probably helps you to be as accurate as possible. I don't know. I like to think about the psychology of stuff like that.
So I think it's also good to think about the psychology of the patient who would you rather be talking to about this news, this surgeon that you trust and that did the biopsy or faceless pathologist that I don't know, doesn't even live in the same state as me, probably.
Yeah.
So I think there's an aspect to the patient as well. But yeah, you're definitely right. It's when I went into pathology, a really unusual case would be sort of exciting to look at. And I just thought that's a little bit morbid because these are human beings.
Yeah. I can see that.
But you have to keep that perspective of you have to want to look at the unusual things so you're good at what you do. But you also have to keep the respect of this is a human who's attached to this diagnosis. And I do see my own patients clinically. So it's a little bit easier for me to maintain that. And I think pathologists do a good job of that anyway. But
Yeah. You mentioned previously, you kind of inferred that some pathologists do have like a private practice setup. Because the other thing I think of when I think of pathologists is that you're tied to a university, you're tied to a lab. That is who your employer would be in some, basically that's where your paychecks come from, is you're employed by a university of some type. I know that's probably the case for like super high majority of pathologists, but there are some that have private practice. How does that work? A private practice for a pathologist?
So there are about... I can think of maybe 6 that produce enough to be sustainable to where the pathologist just does oral pathology. And they've been around for a long time. It's very difficult to start up a new lab. But you're right. I would say 90% of us are tied to universities. And, for me, that's a huge part of what I do as an oral pathologist is teach dentists.
Yeah.
So
that was my next question. You are faculty at a school.
Yeah. Yeah.
What school?
I'm currently at University of Kentucky in Lexington, I was at University of Texas at Houston. And before that I was at West Virginia University. So
what is the, what's the caseload like for a student coming in? You take pathology, like a second year class, and then there's a couple, you take it like once a year. Is it like a,
depends on what school actually, it depends on the school. So each school has their own curriculum. Here we are pretty pathology heavy. University of Kentucky has a long list of very famous oral pathologists. At least, you know, I think they're famous. So
like the Brad Pitt of oral pathology.
Exactly. So I'm just too happy to be here. But so, you know, it's very pathology heavy here. So they have general path in their second year, oral path, a full year of it, you know, two semester classes. And then in their fourth year, they have another full semester class.
Okay. So I'm going to get a little off topic now. Are you familiar with a stain called methylene blue?
Methylene blue. I know toluidine blue. Is that the same?
I don't know. I have no idea. Here's what I know. I'm getting,
Google it. Yeah.
I have a story. So when I was an undergrad, I was in a microbiology lab and, we were doing histology staining. And we were staining things, and there was like, there's like red stains and blue stains, and you use different stains that highlight different little creatures and like structures and anatomical features that you're looking for within certain slides. So there's one that was called methylene blue. Now I'm not super sciencey about what it does. All I know is my teacher said never eat or consume methylene blue because it'll dye your urine blue. So I immediately So I immediately put a bottle of it in my pocket, a whole bottle, and I took it home. I stole it from the microbiology lab. I think I'm past the statute of limitations now, so I'm not worried about confessing my crimes. And I bought a brownie package from the grocery store because I wanted to mix it and feed it to my roommates. So but I knew I couldn't use like ice cream or like anything that, because it's blue. I mean, it dyes everything.
It would look blue. Yeah. It would
be blue. So I thought brownies are perfect because brownies are dark and I could mix it in with the brownies and they wouldn't see it. And it totally worked. And I made a batch of brownies. I was like, hey guys, I just made some brownies. You guys want some brownies? And I don't know why they weren't suspicious of this.
You didn't make brownies often?
No, no, I did not. Nor did I ever do nice things for my roommates. So it was... It was far outside my character, but I was like, here, guys, have some brownies that I made out of the blue for you.
Don't worry. It still is.
Yeah.
He's never made me brownies, like ever.
Don't eat them if he does.
Right. Because they for sure have something in them that's going to do something funny to you.
I'm a victim of experiments all the time.
Okay. But it was within, I would say, a few hours later that night, that two of my roommates, like simultaneously, I hear these like screams coming from the bathroom. These like, what's going on? And I go back and they're like freaking out. They're like, my pee is blue, like pool water blue. And I was like, that's really weird, man. I'm fine. I don't know what you're talking about. Anyway, later I told them what I did.
And so you didn't eat the brownie?
Later I did. Yeah, I wanted to try it. But I wanted to see it. I want to see how it works first. I used them as guinea pigs.
So you made them brownies and they just took them and you weren't eating them?
Correct.
I feel like that's a little bit on them.
Yeah, totally. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Right. Like you have to, you know, if you think you're being poisoned, you got to make your captor drink the poison first.
Right.
Anyways, but later I was like, it was so cool. Like they showed me the water afterwards and I was like, that's kind of awesome. And it's not like, I looked it up and I felt pretty well. I mean, I looked it up to the best I could and I felt like it wasn't bad for you. So I was like, let's do it. So I downed some and peed blue for a night and it was fantastic and it was fun. I was wondering if oral pathologists ever get together and do brownie parties like that. Probably not.
No.
So boring. No. You guys are so boring. Oh man. Anyway, that's my fun. That's my fun histology story that I feel like you you could appreciate more than most.
I can't think of any, you know, even pranks that we do.
Well, if you get your hands on some methylene blue,
our group texts are mostly, "Hey, do you know what this is?" And not, "Do you know how to obtain methylene blue?"
Say, "Hey, you guys want to have some brownies? I just made some brownies." Also, brownies has the pot, you know, connotation too. So it was, yeah. So anyway, it works really well and it's really funny. Okay. So here's my question. So back to some serious questions now.
Okay.
Boo.
Okay. Do you feel like if you were in private practice for a day, that your initial exam would be different than the average traditional initial exam? Like, would you be doing more things to look for things? Are there things that are overlooked enough by dentists that you would be like, this should be a part of every single initial exam, looking for specific pathology, be it oral cancer or something else that I'm not thinking of? And oral, I always go back to oral cancer because oral cancer is the big one. You know, dentists don't deal with life and death very often. Right. Very little of what we do is urgent, an urgent matter, right? Especially if you're thinking life and death, like urgent because it might hurt you, but like it won't kill you. And squamous cell carcinoma could, or other, there are other things that could be quite, you know, life-threatening. So do you feel like there are things that dentists should definitely be paying attention to, maybe more than they are, or maybe just that's something that I would do if I was in private practice?
So I think what you're doing, it sounds like what I recommend is every patient, every time. So even if you have a person like me, you know, or even younger, let's say you have a 25-year-old female patient, even if they do smoke or drink, those aren't risk factors at age 25. It takes a while. Still, that person needs an oral cancer screen. So every patient, every time. That's my big thing that I like to harp on. You know, we want to catch the leukoplakias before the white patches, before they turn into cancer. And then the other one I was going to mention when you said you found a gingival carcinoma, those are really difficult, to, if you're not used to looking at them every day, they can mimic other things. They can look like periodontal disease or reactive proliferations. So I always say if it doesn't respond appropriately to therapy the first time, let's take a look back at our diagnosis and maybe get a biopsy. So every patient, every time, even young people are allowed to have oral cancer, and gingival cancers look different.
So when you say an oral cancer screening, is it enough to simply, you know, I call it kind of looking underneath the rug a little bit, like you grab the tongue, you pull it up, you're looking at the side, you're looking at the back, you're really, you know, fish hooking their lips, making the patient bite down and pulling their lips around so you can kind of see every aspect of the gum tissue. Or I know there's like tools that like a little diagnostic type of aids.
Yeah.
That I don't know what the name of it, the name is escaping me, but there's like, is it enough to look, or are there tools that should be incorporated into the oral cancer screening in your opinion?
So there's, you know, the autofluorescence devices are probably what you're talking about. There's a few on the market. So what I like to do and I give advice is use the 2017 article that JADA had on its cover in October. And it was the Center for Evidence-Based Dentistry that Dr. Mark Lingen and his co-authors published, right? So I've got some data to back me up. And their official recommendation is you don't need to use these adjuncts. Now, that all being said, the way I don't use the adjuncts, but I'm very comfortable in knowing that's not right, that is. So if you don't, you said so yourself, you don't see pathology every day, you know, I do. So I might want an adjunct if I had to diagnose a cavity.
Okay. Sure.
So that being said, the official ADA recommendation, Center for Evidence-Based Dentistry, says we don't use these or don't need to. We don't recommend against them. But I am going to have to cough here, so I need to pause for a second.
You can do it. We allow it.
I ran out of water. but the caveat is there. Is the way these tools were tested is that you saw the white lesion and then you use the adjunct to help you decide whether or not to biopsy. And that's not how people are using these instruments, right? They're using them as they are looking with their eyes and then they're shining this light. And there's no official recommendation on whether or not to use the adjunct in that way. And I think as long as you're not using it to profit off of your patients, I think it's totally fine to... Yeah. Make sure you're looking twice, actually.
What is it with dentists and lights? Because they get that light for the whitening too, which doesn't do anything. And so you have these bright blue lights, and you get the lights for the autofluorescent stuff for the cancer stuff. And you're like, just don't, dinosaurs are obsessed with lights, aren't we?
So I think like the first system came out, rather than autofluorescence, they were tissue reflectance. So instead of turning brown, the you know, bad stuff would turn white. And that is basically what they do in gynecological exams when they're looking for precancer.
So basically, you're saying I'm a board certified gynecologist. That's what I'm hearing.
Okay, you're gonna have to repeat yourself. You're saying what?
You're saying that I could definitely be a gynecologist if I needed to be.
I am not saying that at all.
Sure.
I knew he was gonna go there eventually. I'm not writing it down.
Listen, she's an expert. She told me. All right. No, I kid. I'm barely manageable as a dentist. I do just enough to be dangerous. Okay. So what about patients? What about like advice for patients? So we talked about what doctors should do. I do want to do, because we have a lot of patients. This is kind of a patient facing podcast. If you're a patient and you're wondering if it's weird. So obviously I think the best would be go to your doctor, go to your dentist, start with the dentist, get a regular checkup, get it someone who's a dentist to look at it. But what can they do, like their own kind of, you know, screenings at home, look at your tongue in the mirror type stuff.
So number one, I think you hit it, dentist specifically. Make sure you go to a dentist, because a lot of patients go to their family physician who don't have the training that dentists have in oral pathology. Because they get maybe a little bit, but it's just not as much training as a dentist will have in what is normal.
Which is weird. It is weird, because I don't know why this little section of the body, like MDs have no, like you go to an ER and an ER doc can, you know, patch you up from a gunshot wound, but they can't pull out a tooth if it's infected.
They could. I don't know.
I've heard that they cannot. I've heard that they're not, it's outside the scope of their.
So what I meant was, I feel like if someone would teach them how to do it, they could be able to do it, but yeah, they're not allowed.
Some of them will give anesthesia blocks, and some of them will not. Like I know like local ERs here, like if you go, so what's interesting is that a lot, you might know this, you might not know this, but there's a lot of ER visits that are dental related. And I think the percentage depends on how rural of an area it is and how many dentists are around and what the dental IQ is of the area. But, you know, you got a lot of dentists, you got a lot of people who they don't want to pay for a dentist, so they go to an ER. So I've heard reports that from ER docs themselves saying like 20% of what we see is a dental visit, and you just can't do much for them. So some of them have trained themselves how to give like dental blocks. So they'll give like a carpaceptocaine to numb it up for, you know, 6 or 7 hours, give them some pain meds and some antibiotics and say, go find a dentist. Yeah. I've never heard of an ER doc actually pulling a tooth out.
Oh no, I don't think they're allowed to.
I think you're right. I think that's correct. I think it's outside the scope. I don't think a hospital would allow it. Some hospitals do have oral surgeons on call that for emergencies, they can bring in an oral surgeon who will then pull the tooth. But that is interesting. Anyway, sorry, I totally.
Maybe they are allowed to. I don't know. I just know that they don't.
I totally derailed your whole thought process, your whole thing there. And I'm sorry,
totally fine.
But I do think,
you made a good point. Go to a dentist instead of a family physician. And that's not, I don't know if that came off across as any way as derogatory toward family physicians, but it's not intended to. It's just
we're allowed to be derogatory.
Just fact check here. It is illegal for a doctor to pull a tooth in an ER.
There you go.
That's what we got Lowell for. He's Googling things for us. He's keeping us honest. You. Yeah, that's what Lowell's great.
So I think the second thing I'd want people to know is cancer doesn't hurt in its early stages. So
that's important.
That's a huge one. So, you know, I saw a lot of patients when I, you know, sort of served these underrepresented areas where they didn't have insurance or what have you, and they would have this ulcer under their tongue they were aware about for a year. And then when it starts hurting, then they go, well, when it's hurting, that means it's invaded the nerve. So any ulcer that's not healing after a couple of weeks, that's got to be evaluated.
Yeah. And that's the name of the game in dentistry in general, right? Just, there's lots of dental pathology that I would call routine dental pathology, meaning like a cavity doesn't hurt. Yeah. You tell someone, I can't tell you how many times you say, I got six cavities. You have six cavities, ma'am. And she says, well, that's weird because nothing hurts.
They don't hurt. Yeah.
And it's like, well, that's why you don't have six root canals. If you needed six root canals, it'd be that there'd be pain involved. Like that, like specifically, yes, it's not supposed to hurt. We've caught it before it's got to the nerve. And now we can fix it so that you don't have to deal with this problem. But it's really lost on people.
Yeah.
How dental problems are not painful typically to begin with. Very rarely. I mean, like cases of like a fracture, like you bite into something, fracture a tooth. Maybe those are, you know, you land face first on a falling off a bicycle. Those types of things hurt right away. But for the most part, these pathological processes are not painful until it's too late.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially the cancer. I've even had, you know, people that should have known better, frankly, that were trained and it just didn't hurt. So they didn't come see me for months and months and months. So
both of my personal examples, my personal experiences were, exactly what you say. They knew about it. It wasn't new. They knew about it for a long time. And they sat on it and didn't do a whole lot about it. And I think, I don't want to like get into the psychology of what they were thinking, but it's almost like they were annoyed by me bringing it to their attention. It wasn't like,
well, they don't have cancer until someone tells them they do. Sometimes there's a certain aspect of that as well. You know, why people don't go to the doctor and, you know, cause they just don't want to know sometimes.
Yeah. So you're not going to get, you would think sometimes as the operating doctor that you caught this and you had the potential to save their life and they'd be grateful and they would tell you how you're their hero. And it was not that way in my situations at all. These conversations were like, I think you really need to go to the surgeon and you need to get a biopsy. And I actually want the surgeon to report back to me. I want you to report back to me when that's done. Like, I'm trying to make sure, like, I did everything, because I'm also thinking about liability on my end. Like, I don't want to also be liable. I want to make sure it's very clear that I did everything in my power to get this person to the right place to get the job done.
Yeah.
And man, they were like annoyed with it. It was definitely a feeling like I annoyed them in those situations. And then I would annoy the oral surgeon to be like, what happened? And
that's okay. It's okay to be annoying.
Well, you have to, in the very rare cases where dentistry is life and death, yeah, you got to put a little bit of urgency, I think.
Right.
All right. Now, we are not going to bring an oral pathologist on the program here without also giving you a case to diagnose. So I don't know if you've seen this, but there is a viral TikTok video made by yours truly. I did not know this was going to go.
Self-promoting viral TikTok video is what we're getting.
Now, I did not know, and this is a case that we had in our office. I want to say in late 2018, a young man, about 17 years old, comes in with a very weird malformation of his two front teeth. So there's two, which are central incisors, for those who don't know. Central incisors, and these are your money makers. This is what they got to look pretty, or else you're never going to make the cover of Cosmopolitan magazine. And his looked like molars. All right. So I made a video about it. Now I'm going to screen share. I'm going to share this video because so we can all listen to my terrible diagnosis and then have an actual expert give us some information that is probably a little more thoughtful and let's just say based in science and fact. Okay. Let's see.
Pull your headphones.
Oh, thank you.
This is, let me just blast this. Okay. It's a minute long.
What I am about to show you, so rare in dentistry, that if you tell a dentist that you think you saw what I'm about to show you, they're going to think,
zoinks.
Did you turn the volume down?
No.
Weird.
All right. All right. So there's a little bit of hyperbole there, a little bit of hyperbole going on there. Before you, hold on, let me put my headphones back in. Okay. Before you bust me on saying that those are molars, because I already know you're saying it. Yeah, those are not molars. I know that. I just thought they looked like molars.
I know that.
So, you know, it's TikTok. So I'm adding a little flair for the
camera. There is, in your defense, I don't know that it's ever happened molar to incisor, but there is something called transposition where teeth can switch places. So for the audience that doesn't know that, it's not.
Yeah, no, that's what's interesting. So then when this goes viral, I think it's up to like 6 million views. It's insane. And so you read through the comments and there's people are saying it's mulberry molars. It's Hutchinson's incisors. It's transposition comes up. I still land on witchcraft as being my number one differential diagnosis on this. I don't know. But listen, that's why I said I got to find somebody who knows more than me who can come in here and say, is it mulberry molars? Is it Hutchinson's incisors? Dr. Ashley Clark, help us with some expertise in this. Now I did post x-rays. I think I sent you some.
So I had a differential in my head before I saw the radiographs. And now once I saw the radiographs, done. We know our diagnosis. But I want to hit on the Hutchinson incisors. So those to me don't look like Hutchinson incisors just because of the location of the notch. So Hutchinson incisors, you know, if you've ever taken a class from me and you're a student of mine, you know, a test question I asked was greatest mesiodistal width is in the middle half. I don't think we see that here. And then they taper like a screwdriver.
Go ahead. My hand's raised.
Yes.
Is this going to make it on one of your tests? Please tell me it's going to make it on one of your tests.
I always ask that question. Oh, no, this particular picture?
Yeah.
I could show it in class tomorrow to see if anyone knows what it is.
If I could just be somebody's test question, I feel like I've made it in life. Anyway, I don't want to push you. Listen, I don't want to manipulate your curriculum, but I just want to.
That would be an interesting bonus. Like, okay.
An extra credit question or something. I don't know.
And, you know, to say, here's what the guesses are. Ain't none of these right. What do you think it is? That would be really interesting.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry. Again, derailed your whole stream. Okay. So Hutchinson's incisors, you're not buying that.
No, I don't think it's that. There is a hypoplastic notch in Hutchinson's incisors. So that is definitely why that was included in some people's differential, because they saw that notch. So that's not out of left field at all. Just not the highest on my list.
And I should mention that the differentials are coming from TikTok users.
Right.
Not the strongest.
I was trying to give credit to the dentists who might be on TikTok who guessed
that. They could be. They don't identify themselves and their handles, the names don't sound very professional most of the time. So I don't know how.
How do lay people know what Hutchinson's incisors are?
I think people are giving it a quick Google. And I think it's like,
that would come up immediately.
Yeah. It's like anything in life. It's like, when people are talking about COVID now, everyone's a virologist. And then when people are talking about, social issues, everyone's a sociologist. Anyway, it's just like, now everyone is an oral pathologist. Once they see this video, they're like, I know what this is. But I saw that and I was like, I didn't think it looked like Hutchinson's incisors, and I didn't think mulberry molars was a good fit either. So I didn't know.
So, the answer is like pretty boring. So the fact,
but it is an answer.
Pardon?
But it is an answer.
It is an answer. So this is dens in dente, if you remember that from dental school. So, and the coronal variant based on the radiograph. So part of the tooth enamel is sort of, you know, going up and dilating and causing this invagination, if you will. Yeah. These are not uncommon. The most common.
Stop it.
You've thought about laughing, dude.
Stop it. Well, this is a professional podcast.
What? Okay, guys.
We are a podcast of learned doctors, Lowell. Bringing that filth in.
And I am the naive person who doesn't understand. I've given you two opportunities to just make.
Hey, I kept my mouth shut most of the time. I could have taken shots and I didn't. I was keeping it cool, but I couldn't let that slide.
It makes me wonder how often I do this in class, like not even knowing. And the students are like, oh my God. But anyway.
Hey, side story. I had a dental anatomy instructor who, because of her accent, she didn't say her THs. Her THs came out as a hard T. So she would often, because she was our dental anatomy instructor, she would often refer to the apical turd of the tooth very commonly. And I, like a 12-year-old adolescent, terrible young boy, would just snicker the entire time. Apical turd. And sometimes I would raise my hand and make sure that my questions required her to say the apical turd of the toot. And it just made my day. Every day made my day.
So I've known you for 49 minutes now. And that honestly does not surprise me.
I've not grown up in the last
45 minute conversation.
That's true. I've not grown up in the last 40 years, let alone just last
40 year old man children, pretty much.
That's all we are.
The best way to live life.
Sorry if you regret your decision to come on our program, Ashley.
No, totally. It is really opening up my, you know, I need to take a look into how I'm presenting things in my own courses. So.
Yeah. Listen, as long as we can be helpful, that's important. Okay. So dens in dente. Is that the same thing as dens in vaginatus?
It's exactly the same thing.
That's the same thing.
But most people remember dens in dente. They don't remember that term. So that's why I went with dens in dente.
Now, I don't remember the background on this patient was he had seen an orthodontist, because if you look at the x-rays, you'll see that 8 and 9 are there. They're up in his palate. And
I'm wondering, he's 17. Are those the permanent teeth that haven't come out yet? Or
he does have 8 and 9 and they're seemingly normal on the x-rays. And if you're looking for the x-rays, you can go to they're on the TikTok. I'm not going to.
Yeah. But so the ones that are affected, are those the permanent teeth?
No, the permanent teeth are up there. And the orthodontist did not want to, they had two options. They were either going to pull those out and do they usually do it with canines. I forget the name.
I will have no clue. So
they attach, open and oral surgeons do all the time. They cut a freaking hole in the person's palate. They attach a bracket to the canine and they attach that to a wire and it pulls the canine down.
Into place.
Exactly right. Because people get impacted canines a little more regularly than you see this. Well, they were going to do that with 8 and 9. I think it seemed more difficult when they were like, well, why don't you, because these have solid roots, pretty decent sized roots that were single rooted, not multi-rooted like a molar would be, which means probably not a good fit to call it molars. The idea was crowning them later. And you can see in the TikTok that we did, we put some composites that day with the intention of doing crowns later. And we've just never seen the guy back ever again. Oh. And maybe he moved, maybe he's satisfied. Because, you know, we did improve the situation.
I was going to say, he's probably just really happy with the work that you did.
That's what I like to think. Yeah. I always think no news is good news for the patient. If I'm not hearing
from them, it's because no news is good news.
right. Absolutely. If I don't hear from you, I assume that you don't have a problem with me. But anyways, okay, so we're thinking it's a dens in dente. That did come up. So if you saw the TikTok and you made a comment that said dens in dente, you win the gold star of TikTok for that video. Good job.
If you said credit, these are most often affect the permanent teeth. And I don't know that I've ever seen two in this particular situation, like the deciduous front incisor, maxillary incisors. I don't know that I've ever seen that. You could publish that if you wanted to.
Is there money involved?
Not a bit.
Yeah, not interested. Is there power or fame? Can I get
attention? Is there
for me? Involved? It would help me personally because I that's part of my job is to publish. Hey,
you could publish it if you want, and you just say go check out Dr. Brady Smith on TikTok.
That's how I'll cite my source. I'll cite a TikTok video.
That's going to get you so far in your career. Ashley. Yes, I don't think
Reviewers will enjoy it.
You're going to be the first oral pathologist who cited TikTok for their resources, and I know it's going to get you places in life. That's amazing.
Here's hope.
Well, we're gonna be posting some of these clips because man, the comments can get mean too. Because if I start saying as a dentist, I was like, I don't think it's Hutchinson. I made some comments like, I don't think it's a mulberry molar. I don't think it's Hutchinson's incisors. And man, there were some people that came out and were like, you don't know what you're talking about. Just Google it. It's exactly what it is. And like, yeah. Google told them. And I was like, I don't think so. Because 8 and 9 are there. And you got the centrals, the adult centrals are there. And those things typically affect your permanent teeth. Anyways, so it's good to get someone. Now I can say, listen, I talked to Dr. Ashley Clark. She's a lot smarter than me. And she said that I'm right 100% of the time. So that's what I'm claiming.
So they're molars.
That's what I heard. That's what I heard. And it was witchcraft, probably, as the different diagnosis.
But I mean, honestly, you can probably say that I said, you know, whatever you want me to say, you probably edit it that way.
We're going to edit this to make me sound right. We're going to edit this to make it sound like this kid was walking through a forest picking up pieces of candy. It led to a house. And in that house, there was a witch who was going to eat him. And so he first thing she did was change his teeth to molars so that he could eat a lot more food and get fatter because the witch wanted to eat him.
How long have you been thinking about that?
Since the day I saw this.
Okay.
I wanted to make my Hansel and Gretel analogy.
So were those teeth vital?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Good. Okay.
Yeah, they were. Yeah, there's a nerve space at that. We had some endodontists who commented. They were like, please post the x-rays. I have to see what this nerve looks like. I got to see what the pulp chamber looks like.
Yeah, I think this is a type 1 coronal disinvaginitis or invaginitis. I'm not quite sure how. Let me get back and look at the radiograph. Let's see here.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I without the radiograph, I wasn't entirely sure. So the one incisor, I can tell for sure based on this radiograph. The other one, I'm pretty sure that's what it is, but I can't tell for sure. But definitely the one tooth, that's exactly what this is. So.
Yeah. All right. Well, hey, that is. Listen,
good job, Doc.
Listen, we have made some progress in the world today, I think. I think we have done enough damage.
Damage is right.
So I really sincerely appreciate you coming on and sharing your expertise, Dr. Clark. There are times we gotta say I don't know, and we defer to people who know a little bit more. So and I think it's super interesting, and obviously so do 6 million other people.
Yeah.
Who aren't necessarily dentists think this is interesting as well. And I think that says something. People like to see things that are not interesting.
That patient's quality of life a lot better too. So you should feel, even if not knowing the exact diagnosis, you should feel good about that, I think.
And let me give full credit to my partner. My business partner was the one who did the composites. My business partner was the one who found it and did the composite and saw it originally. And she's fantastic. Her name is Dr. Erica Lenz. And she is an amazing dentist. And it was a patient that fell in her lap in my office. It was my office, but also she was the one who did it. So full credit where it deserves to go. We do want to, if people have questions, first of all, you can email drilledpodcast@gmail.com, email us. I don't know if you want to put anything out there. If people have questions about oral pathology, if dentists have questions, is there a way to contact you? Do you want to put something out there where people can ask questions if they have follow-ups that we didn't get to that they have burning in their brain?
So I have a Facebook page. I think it's @oral pathology speaker. So you can send private messages to that. It's a public page. I don't always respond in the timeliest of fashion. So you have to ping me again if I forget to answer the first time. But that's always an option. For dentists, if you need a speaker or a pathologist, you can look me up at our website.
Fantastic. Fantastic. We'll put that out there too in our show notes as well. Listen, everybody, thank you for joining us. Lowell, anything to add?
No, I think I'm good. I was drinking it in.
Yeah, you were. Yeah, you were. Until we said the word.
I was feeling a bit bad for you, to be honest.
Don't. Don't stop that right now. He's fine. Look at him. He's got two guitars behind him. He's got a ukulele.
I'm in a closet, literally, like a closet.
Yeah. Oh no. I wish my husband would put his guitars up in the closet like that. It would look a lot nicer.
Yeah. Lowell's in an awesome man cave right now. Don't feel bad for him. Okay. Listen, everyone, thanks for joining us. I hope this was beneficial. If you have questions, things you want to, things we should have followed up on, things you wish you knew about oral pathology or weird things in the mouth, email us at drilledpodcast@gmail.com. Maybe we do a follow-up. Ashley Clark is now a friend of the podcast, and we might do a little follow-up if we need to. So I appreciate you coming on and sharing this with us, Dr. Clark. Anything you want to add?
No, thanks for having me.
Fantastic. Okay, guys, join us next week when it's probably back to me and Lowell doing something
probably
less intellectual, less smart.
Maybe we get pretty thinky. I mean, you're always downplaying it, dude.
Oh, we think. I don't know if it's. I don't know how.
We have deep thoughts, you know.
We do our best.
I did enjoy the one where you told the stories a long time ago of getting kicked out of the Facebook group. I did enjoy that. So.
Oh yeah, yeah, that was great. I have been kicked out of a few Facebook groups, so I can be relied
for
upon.
Comments, so.
I can be relied upon for that all the time. All right, Dr. Clark, thank you so much for hanging out with us. Join us next week, everybody. Be sure to leave a review on the podcast where you can, and share with everyone you know. Bye-bye.